Test, test. Test, test. Audio test. Good afternoon, ICANN64. Tuesday, March 12th. This is the GAC Governance and Accountability Process, 3 of 3.
So welcome back, everyone, and apologies for the five-minute delay. We're starting. We have three 30-minute sessions. We're going to start by the CCWG accountability recommendations. This is the cross-community working group on ICANN accountability and the recommendations that were released in Barcelona. Since we have less than 30 minutes, I'll hand over immediately to you, Rob, for the slides, and then we can have our discussion. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Manal. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Rob Hogarth. The purpose of this first session is really to give you a high-level background briefing about CCWG accountability developments. And as we were envisioning this session for this afternoon, the thought was not to have it be the traditional come in and give a lecture, but actually tie it into some of the strategic direction of the GAC, following up on some of the themes that we've discussed about improvements in operating principles, early warnings, the concept of being up to speed and prepared for issues before they hit. So this fits into that general context. So the idea is to give you some consideration options for potentially developing an inventory and tracking of the recommendations that impact the GAC, and talk about potential approaches to ultimately achieve full implementation. Because basically the work of the cross-community working group is done. It's now in the board's hands to decide what recommendations the board wants to accept. But for the most part, if it's not ICANN.org, the structures or bodies that are responsible for implementing these recommendations sit in this room and in the other SONAC meeting rooms around this building today. So part of this effort is really to tee up for you this recognition that this assignment is coming. There's a recognition, I think, that a number of you in this room have helped contribute to some of these recommendations. And so we're hopeful that there's an opportunity for some dialogue and some insight.
Yeah, just very quickly for the sake of new GAC members, this cross-community working group was formed during the IANA transition thing. So when the cross-community working group on the IANA transition was formed, the question was, when the transition happens, whom would ICANN be accountable to? And then this cross-community working group was formed to look into ICANN accountability, and they came up with the recommendations that Rob will take us through. And we have so many GAC members here in the room who were very active in this working group, and I invite them to weigh in their thoughts and share their experiences as well. So back to you, Rob.
Thank you, Manal. We were joking up here ahead of time that actually I would offer for all the working group members to correct me or clarify my remarks if you catch me saying anything that's inappropriate or inaccurate with respect to your deliberations. Next slide, Gulten, please. Manal has already touched a little bit about the background, and thank you for doing that. The work stream one was essentially the foundational element for the work stream two discussions. And many in the room here are very familiar with the tremendous amount of effort and work that went into work stream one. But at a certain point, there was a recognition that there are a number of critical, important items with respect to the accountability of the organization and its various components, including the GAC, that there really needed to be more work done. And so that created the concept and idea for the second work stream of conversations to look into a variety of different areas. It's important to note for some of you who are new is that the GAC was one of the organizations that initially supported it, was a chartering organization of the work effort. And back in Barcelona, for those of you who were here, may recall that that was an opportunity for the GAC to decide whether it would accept those recommendations. And we'll talk about that in a moment. And as Manal has noted, a number of you were participants in that effort. That was also, I'm hearkening back to Cavus's comments earlier about the amount of work that went into the recent EPDP efforts. Well, there was a similar huge amount of work, both for work stream one and work stream two on the part of the community. So very exhaustive, very thorough, and as a result, as Manal noted, a tremendous number of recommendations. Now, in terms of the types of topics, there were nine major work areas that I've got there on the slide. Many of you I see have looked up behind me and already read them. What I'll turn to on the next slide, Gulten, is the individual work areas or subgroups that were most important or have the potential impact for implementation by the GAC. So of the nine original topics, a number of them remain very important, but in terms of actual follow-up and a commitment from all of you here, there are really just five major areas. Recommendations about diversity, recommendations about the application of a framework of interpretation for human rights, the jurisdiction issue, which had some notable discussion here within the GAC and was in fact the one area of the recommendations that the GAC did not support. SOAC accountability, which is right in the wheelhouse of this committee, as well as transparency. And so a tremendous number of recommendations. If you see the final report with all its appendices, it's close to 200 pages. But what I tried to do was just find a couple of highlights and maybe some examples to give you a sense of what the GAC and, frankly, other SOs and ACs is going to be facing once these recommendations get resolved. Next slide, please, Gulten. So I mentioned this, and I thought it was important for you all to remember it. In the Barcelona communique, the GAC accepted the recommendations, but also stated that the GAC is not in a position to approve or reject the recommendations on jurisdiction. And it noted, and I remember this this conversation, some GAC members support. Other GAC members consider that they fall short of the objectives envisioned for the work stream too, and only partly mitigate the risks associated with ICANN's subject to U.S. jurisdiction. And so based on the collective feedback, even noting those concerns, the cross-community working group submitted their final recommendations to the ICANN board back in the early November timeframe. Next slide, Gulten. So the next steps are that the board has to resolve these recommendations, discuss them, and come up with reasons for accepting or plans for how they might begin to implement them before accepting. And in late January at the board workshop in Los Angeles, the board confirmed that there are several steps that they're going to take before they put the recommendations into action. And you see those on the slide. Assembling a small implementation team, convening a caucus group that will potentially monitor the implementation, and I think the biggest sort of project is to have an implementation assessment report developed by the ICANN organization to consider the feasibility of some of the recommendations. And what I noted is that if you look and see some of the budget documentation, the only resources currently that are being allocated in the FY20 draft budget for Workstream 2 is that it's viewed as a contingency. And I don't know whether that's an indication that it will take a lot longer for the recommendations to go through the board process, or if it's a recognition that many of us have experienced in the ICANN world that once something's approved, it takes several months for people to get up to speed, to get some momentum going, and so why commit funds when things are really only going to be starting in FY21 or in about a year and a half? Next slide, please. So what I wanted to do was just show you an implementation case study that's of direct application to all of us. I say that because staff has a number of obligations in this for implementation. And one of the areas in particular from an accountability standpoint that was focused on by the working group was what are the new accountability expectations of the members of the ICANN community. You'll recall that, you know, this was a case with the IANA transition, that there was an expectation that there would be a substantial recommitment, if you will, of the ICANN supporting organizations and advisory committees. And clearly, these recommendations spell that out. This is just to give you an example of some of the areas that you would be expected, if these recommendations were accepted, to begin to document and pay attention to. It's great that I have Fung sitting right next to me, because potentially these are duties of a working group like the Operating Principles Evolution Group. So a few examples: documenting the decision-making methods of the organization, documenting the procedures for members to challenge the process, documenting procedures for non-members, and I'm not sure how this would ever be applicable, but you get the idea of, you know, having as much as possible in place that demonstrates how an organization conducts its affairs. There's even a bullet point there for the documentation of unwritten procedures and customs that have been developed in the course of practice. Again, the concept and overall theme of this working group on accountability was to create accountability. And as a result, that really means documenting what your processes are and then over time adhering to those processes. And over time as well, reporting and showing that, in fact, that is taking place. There are a number of things right when the recommendations get adopted or go into place that talk about producing reports, doing inventories. All of these things are for you all to decide how you will assign those or assign roles and responsibilities, because there will be a lot of data gathering. One of the thoughts that staff had in terms of future discussions with the leadership is teeing up some of this work now. Even if these recommendations aren't ultimately accepted, one could argue that they are best practices from a management standpoint. So there's a good bit of logic behind that. Finally, if you look at the bottom two bullet points here, there's a reinforcement of the empowered community and this recognition that the SOs and ACs who make up the empowered community have their own roles and responsibilities. The GAC is one of those organizations. And right now, since the empowered community is still somewhat in its infancy, that's likely to mature. Some of those processes may be tested over time, and it's important to have concepts and ideas in place. If I recall correctly, Manal, there were some preliminary or initial sort of processes that the GAC adopted for, you know, exercising its empowered community administration obligations. But I think even those are just recognized as temporary, and that they would ultimately be codified, or there would be some sort of permanence produced for them. And so these are the types of things where the expectations are coming up, and where, from an organizational standpoint, the committee is going to have to pay attention to it. And I'm sorry for presenting it in this way, because My remarks previously this week have been focused on, we want to create the atmosphere where you all can focus on the substance of the work. And then we turn, and we'll talk a little bit later in the next half hour about reviews, but there's this very important aspect of the multi-stakeholder model that really has the community governing itself. And so there is a natural floor level of administration and process that unfortunately, or fortunately, goes along with that. Can we go to the next slide, please?
Just to comment on what you said, Rob. First of all, the GAC being one of the decisional participants of the empowered community, we also participate in the empowered community administration, which is a representative from each SO and AC, and the GAC has agreed to designate the chair on temporary basis for this task until we agree on things. And there is a document that was under discussion, and it needs to be finalized, as you highlighted, Rob. So this is helpful to bring everyone up to speed so that when we come to finalize our internal matters, all GAC members are aware where we stand, and also when things come to us as a decisional participant within the empowered community, again, we can be ready to respond. So thank you, Rob.
Thank you. So let's talk about next steps briefly. I have one offer to you all and then a request for feedback. First is the offer that it certainly seems to us from a staff perspective that it's advisable to move forward as if these recommendations were going to be accepted. We may be fortunate and they aren't accepted for 6 or 8 months. I don't think it'll be 6 or 8 weeks. So it'll, you know, put the committee in a place to be prepared for when the recommendations come on board. So it's not what we call in the U.S. the fire drill of running around and figuring out, putting you in more of a posture of proactivity and not reactivity. And so that's something that the staff is going to take on in terms of just going through the accountability recommendations, creating some sort of document that demonstrates, or at least from our interpretation of the recommendations, what sort of next steps or obligations the committee would have as a whole. Where it would be very helpful to get feedback or guidance, and maybe some of you who participated in the group could help us here, it's figuring out what other possible courses of actions might exist. Two that I, you know, came up with after thinking about this for some time is seem to settle around what you were just talking about in the subsequent procedures discussions before lunch, deciding if there is sense in putting together a small group or a person who is willing to sort of think about this and sort of be responsible for saying, yes, I will keep an eye on this. Let's, you know, work with the staff and figure out what we can produce and help the committee down the road. It could be a new working group or whatever you want to call it, or it could be, and this is where I turn to Fung and Pear, it could be, you know, assigning something to an existing working group for all the responsibilities. And then there's a third option. And I think we're already seeing that in the work plans of some of the working groups. As I look out and see Suwada and Jorge, for example, they've already, you know, identified the fact that there's this framework of interpretation, have already had some extensive discussions about that, and there'd be some natural alignment there on some of those areas to have the working groups include those in their work plans, and maybe over the course of the next year come up with some ideas and recommendations. So that's sort of where we are on that, Manal. I would be delighted if any of the former volunteers for the working groups identified something that needs to be clarified from me or has any recommendations. And if you don't have any right now, please let's chat later in the week. Happy to chat with you about it. I'm finishing a little early so we have more time to talk about ICANN reviews, perhaps.
Sorry. Any questions or remarks? Yes, Olga, please. Argentina.
Thank you, Manal. Thank you, Rob. You did a great job. I mean, it's a good summary of all the work that we did. And I think there should be an eye from the GAC along the process. And I think just without a lot of reflection in this moment, perhaps this idea of a working group, I don't know if it should be only one of us looking at it. I would rather think about a small group that could work together. But I think that there is value in that idea and looking from the GAC perspective along the process. Thank you.
Thank you, Olga. Yes, Switzerland. Jorge, please.
Thank you, Manal. Jorge Cancio, Switzerland, for the record. Thank you very much, Rob. I think this is very, very helpful that we take a proactive approach to this. I guess that perhaps the first step would be to do a mapping or a broad mapping of what the recommendations are, and then try to figure out what existing work stream is most useful to cover each part. For instance, I can imagine that some of the transparency recommendations would fit very well into the working group on, how is it called, operating principles, more or less. And, of course, the FOI fits very well with the working group of human rights, as you said before. And then on that basis, perhaps that could be a good briefing for Marrakesh, we can decide how best to organize.
Thank you. Thank you, Jorge. I think this is a sensible starting point and would be helpful to GAC colleagues. Fong, please. I'm sorry. China.
Thank you, Manel, for this chance to make an intervention, and thank you, Rob, for this briefing. I think I have 3 points. In the slide, Rob had touched upon some of the points relating to the AC and SO accountability. I think the working group on the GAC operating principle can take some of the points to take some task to work on those points. And number two, I personally think that if we form a working group on the accountability implementation regarding WS2, I think it might be a good idea. Perhaps personally, I will volunteer for a member of this working group. And third, now we have the ATRT 3 get started. So as you may know that I think that accountability is always a topic within ICANN and will be an everlasting topic. So I think we can also use that channel to channel the GAC's position, the GAC's concerns regarding accountability into the ATRT3 processes. We also have a colleague, which is my colleague, appointed by the GAC as the a member in the ATRT3, and so we can, through this channel, we can follow the ATRT3. So I stop here. Thank you.
Thank you, Fong. And yes, Russia, please.
Thank you, Andrew Zhu of Russian Federation, for the record. We would like to talk about the part of the report that is concerning the jurisdiction. And as you mentioned, there were several concerns raised by several countries on the immunity of the ICANN that for some reasons could not be properly discussed during the CCVG, and we would like to know what is the future process for addressing these concerns, how they will be addressed in future. Thank you.
This is Rob Hogarth. I think that's an open question at the moment. I don't think that there are any existing sort of processes that are immediately envisioned or processed. Please tell me if I have that incorrect at the present time that sort of lay out a path for what happens there next. I think bringing the topic of the CCWG, though, up in the context of the GAC gives those who are interested in that an opportunity to say, what should we do as a committee in terms of what some of the next steps for that might be, in terms of encouraging ICANN to undertake a new process, find different ways to, again, raise that issue. So I think it, in some respects, the length of time that it's taking to adopt the recommendations can, I guess, cut both ways in terms of whether that keeps the issue alive or, you know, takes more time for it to come back. But I guess that's something for you all as a committee to decide if, in fact, the lack of resolution on that needs to have another process. I don't know if that was a satisfactory answer, but that's all I have.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you, Rasha, for raising the question. Any other comments? Okay, if not, then we're just on time for our following session on ICANN reviews. And Fong, you mentioned ATRT3, and we've been discussing CCT and many other acronyms. Sorry, Rasha. Go ahead.
Thank you. Just to continue this discussion and stop it over here, yes, we understand that we need to, as a GAC, to understand what will be the future steps, and that is an open question. But could I ask you, Manal, to discuss it with the board and to understand the position of the board on this issue? It would be great to have a feedback from them. Thank you.
So you mean at the session this evening, or...? Just check and get back to you on the topic.
Whether you see it appropriate.
Okay, so I'll check and get back to you because I don't think this was one of the questions we already shared with the board, and I'm not sure they will be prepared to provide an answer during this coming session, but I'll get back to you before the end of the week. Thank you. So anything else on the accountability before we move on? Okay, if not, then so the next 30 minutes are on ICANN reviews, and as I was mentioning, there are different reviews. You've been hearing us saying ATRT and CCT, and there is the SSR2, so this is the time to unpack those acronyms and know what they stand for, and I think we have the slides up, so shall I hand over to you, Rob? Okay.
Thank you, Manal. This is Rob Hogarth for the record. The goals for this 30 minutes are relatively simple and straightforward as well. And Catherine, you can come up at any time. I know you're toward the end of the agenda for a nice segue, but it'd be nice to have your company. The idea here, as Manal suggested, is really to provide an overview, give you a little context. As you're probably picking up in the theme of this week, there are a number of the issues that, quite frankly, overlap quite a bit. And we'll be talking about in one session about a review and then realize it's connected to another topic. And that's happening here as well. We're talking about some reviews that, as Fung noted, we'll get a slightly different perspective on tomorrow with a liaison and points of contact approach. But we thought it was useful for a 30-minute period, as Manal said, to do a little bit of acronym checking, getting you all up to speed in terms of where some of these things sit. So the idea is to give you a high-level background, provide some context, let you make a few of those connections where you see, oh, that review connects with this initiative and that project connects with that community. So I hope that you'll find that useful. And the other side of that is that if you all see more connections between these various pieces, then you can begin to think strategically about how, as a committee, you want some of these reviews to work best for governments, how these different types of reviews can be leverage points for some of the policy advice that you want to provide. And I think we'll get into that at about minute 29 or 30 with Catherine, where we talk about the fact that a number of you participate in various reviews. You actually see how they work and how they don't work, and how can the committee provide some level of influence on that. Not because it directly impacts a particular public policy issue, but because it ultimately impacts the process or the framework in which those policy discussions take place. And if you can help work with those, evolve some of those, then maybe you can create a much more efficient system for some of the work that you want to do. So if we can go to the next slide, Gulten. Let's talk very briefly, but I think this is important. What are reviews at ICANN? For many folks who've been at ICANN for a while, and for some of the cynical ones, they go, oh my goodness, you know, ICANN reviews itself again and again and again. And I think, and I threw the little phrase here, that reviews are part of ICANN's DNA. They really are. And the concept is that if the multi-stakeholder community is going to work effectively, then it does need to evaluate, is the system working? Does the process satisfy the needs of the various groups? Finding a balance is important in that respect. The challenge is, how do you have a system of reviews that are productive and don't become this circus wheel where all you're doing is reviewing the reviews and reviewing the reviews? And so there's an organizational challenge there, because I think many of you have observed over the years, usually a new initiative at ICANN also prompts one or two or three new review processes. And if you take the previous comments seriously, that the goal is to help you focus on the actual substantive issues, that sort of defeats the purpose if you're, you know, constantly doing administration. But again, it's a balance, because if you don't do that reconsideration, then the model eventually can grow stale or collapse or on its own weight. So again, it's a very important concept that is fundamental to the ICANN organization. And over time, we've recognized that there are different types of reviews. So there are reviews of the structures that take place, and there are specific reviews mandated by the ICANN bylaws that focus on different operational areas. Today, we're going to focus mainly on specific reviews. In some respects, for you all, operational reviews aren't really that important. Some of the more savvy of you will recognize that the GAC has no review obligations. So there's no process within ICANN for you all to be reviewed. For all the other communities in ICANN, there are expectations and timetables in which they are reviewed independently, not by themselves, but by outside parties who assess whether they're achieving their goals, whether their processes are effective for the times. And so it's a very interesting dynamic between these reviews of structures and the reviews of operations. Yes, Manal.
Yes, just to highlight on what you have said on the special nature of the GAC. So as Rob mentioned, the GAC doesn't have any review obligations, but this is done with the accountability and transparency review teams, we have GAC representation on those review teams. They come back with some recommendations for improvements for the GAC, and the vehicle for implementing those recommendations is the joint GAC board working group, which was actually initially formed specifically for this purpose, but then its scope was widened to interactions between the GAC and the board in general. But the main focus of this working group initially was to implement GAC-related recommendations from the accountability and transparency review teams 1 and 2, where they provided some sort of guidance on how to improve things, again, without going through the normal review obligations of other SOs and ACs. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Manal. This is Rob Hogarth. That was a perfect, unplanned but instinctive intercession on your part. Because if we go to the next slide, Julia, the types of reviews we're going to talk about, again, just very briefly for these, again, to give you a flavor, to give you a sense as to where these things stand, we're going to talk about the accountability and transparency review efforts, the security and stability reviews. You notice the numbers afterwards. This means that there are different iterations. If it says three, that means there were two already before it. The IANA function review, the operating standards for organizational reviews, which many of us jokingly refer to as the review of reviews. And then what Catherine's going to help us with, particularly because there's actual news with respect to this review team, insights on the latest with respect to the RDS Who Is To review. Next slide, please. Oh, yes, Manal.
Just to apologize that I keep getting in advance of your very well-planned slides, but I'm having difficulties with my email, and I haven't seen the slides before, so this is the big secret. So I don't know what's coming up, so I apologize.
It's perfect, because it shows that there's some logic to them, so I'm happy that somehow that works. So accountability and transparency, and again, some of the savvy of you could explain to me, how does an accountability and transparency review jive with a CCWG on accountability, and where do they overlap, where do they come together, why are we doing these two different reviews? There are different histories with some of these reviews, and we could have a 45-minute session on each one. I'm not going to do that for you. But just, again, this is issue spotting, giving you perspective. And the neat thing about Manal's latest intercession with respect to ATRT3, and frankly any of the ATRTs, is that, as I shared with you, the GAC does not have a formal review obligation. But this is ICANN, so guess what? Somebody figured out we can use the ATRT to evaluate the GAC and, you know, get involved in their affairs and recommend some ways that they could improve their work. And that's indeed what happened with respect to ATRT2. The ability of the ATRT review process can touch on many things. For the purposes of this committee, there is a defined expectation that it will assess the role and effectiveness of the GAC's interaction with the board and with the broader ICANN community, and making recommendations for improvement to ensure effective consideration by ICANN of GAC input on the public policy aspects of the technical coordination of the DNS. That's quite a mouthful, but what it essentially comes down to, and what was the result of a lot of very productive work over the last several years, is this new effective communications channel that the GAC has with the board through the BGIG and other interactions over time. So on the next slide, we'll see a little bit about what happened one ATRT ago. So ATRT3 is just starting. The previous review team effort came up with 9 different recommendations for how the GAC could improve its work and processes. And I've got these listed here, and they're 6.1, 6.2, because of the 12 recommendations at the time, the GAC portion was recommendation 6. And over time, all of these have been in some way, shape, or form implemented. So you can see, you know, there was a fairly extensive study by other members of the ICANN community about what the GAC did, how it operated, how it interacted with the board, which is really the critical element that the rest of the community is most interested in, and addressed all these. One might ask, is that what's going to happen with ATRT3? Did the GAC input enough improvements with the second review team that ATRT3 may have 3 recommendations? We don't know. But that's something that with this work team, this review team just starting, that information will become evident fairly soon. Next slide, please. So, as I said, the group has just gotten started. The 18-member team was announced in December. There's a little lag time in getting it going. The GAC has nominated a member of the team. Feng already referenced that. One of his colleagues, Mr. Liu, he's going to be with us tomorrow morning, just providing an overview of what he does and what he's seeing is going on with that effort. And the team has already been conducting meetings. From a staff perspective, what we've been asked to do is help collect the information and data that demonstrates whether the GAC is living up to the spirit and letter of its ATRT2 obligations. So that's something that we're already involved in. Next slide, please. So that's ATRT2. Review security and stability, SSR2, is underway and has actually moved along fairly substantially in its progress. Again, as a specific review, there's a bylaw provision that says this review will take place, and that specifies precisely what the review should be undertaking, what areas it should look at, what sort of metrics it may need to check on. And so that's very specific. Again, this is the second SSR2, the SSR2. So this review team will have, like others that have succeeded a previous review team, its first step is to go back and see if the previous recommendations were adopted, holding ICANN and the community group accountable to whether they took the recommendations seriously and actually did something about it. Can we go to the next slide, Gulten? So in this case, the SSR2 was paused for a period of time. There were some membership matters that needed to be resolved. The group restarted just in August of last year. Up until a couple of months ago, the GAC had a representative on that group. Unfortunately, that representative needed to step down. Some of you may recall my email that went out letting you know that and giving you the opportunity to volunteer to be a substitute or take that role. We didn't get any volunteers, and It's not illogical to realize that this group has moved along quite substantially. And so I think the email also flagged the fact that there was going to be a tremendous amount of intense work. And it's kind of hard for somebody new to come on with the dynamics of the group. But because we no longer have a GAC representative on that group, those of you in particular who are interested in security and stability issues should take an occasion every 2 or 3 weeks just to check out progress on this group. We don't currently have an activity page set up on the website for this. Would certainly be happy to set that up if there is some interest on the part of all of you to follow this. So please let us know if this is an area that you want to pay particular attention to. I know a number of us just inside conversations have talked about the value of the GAC, potentially looking into security issues, learning more about those topics. This might be an area to spark some of that. Right now, this review effort is moving along fairly quickly. They hope to have a draft final report by the next ICANN meeting in Marrakesh and to wrap everything up with a final report, at least planned right now, for the Montreal meeting. So moving on to our next candidate here, the IANA naming function review. This is a case, and I don't know if I see Andreas in the room, but I'd like to thank Andreas Dlamini, who volunteered to take on the GACS representation in this effort. Thank you very much. I know you felt a little frustrated because you were nominated by the committee almost 4 or 5 months ago now, and this group is still working to get itself organized. That seems to be coming together now. One of the reasons why it's taken some time is, again, the bylaws require a certain allocation or representational layout to ensure that there is a broad cross-function of the community participating. And in the case of the IFR, they didn't have one or two of the spots filled. And actually this week the board is going to be hoping to resolve that, where there is a non-CCNSO CCTLD slot that has not been filled, that needs to be filled before this group can get the approval to proceed. So this week, actually, the board was planning, or at least it was being put on their agenda, to resolve this issue. So before long, Andreas, you'll actually have an opportunity to report at a future meeting about something actually going on with this group. But again, this is one of those areas where, from an operational standpoint, it's very important to be able to understand what's going on, very important to make sure that ICANN, or in this case PTI, which is an offshoot of ICANN, a separate organization, that it is doing what it's supposed to do. And being able to review this activity is fundamental to some of the work that ICANN does and to making sure that the DNS is operating appropriately. So some of these reviews are not just, gee, are you having enough meetings and are you reporting the results, but it's very fundamentally looking at operational matters that are critical to the health and success, not only of the organization, but the underlying work that it does. Let's go on to the next review effort, Gulten. This is what I wittingly referred to you all as the review of reviews. There's a recognition that with all these reviews, it's very important to have consistency, at least consistency of process, consistency of how the groups are set up, that they're doing what they need to do in terms of just organizational roles and functions. And so the ICANN organization on its own developed this inquiry to make sure that the community had an opportunity to comment on how that was all working. And so that is looking to wrap up fairly soon as well. And that guidance, I think it's hoped, will govern future reviews and allow a little bit more consistency, enable ICANN to be more efficient generally with how it manages its reviews. Yes, Manal.
Yes, just quickly to note the frequency of those reviews, because the, for example, the accountability and transparency review, I think it's done no less frequently than every 5 years, and same thing for the stability and security also, it's no less than 5 years. For the competition, consumer trust and consumer choice, it's 1 year from the new GTLD round has been in operations. So, I mean, by the time the review is completed and it's time for the new review and other processes as well, maybe looking into similar aspects like the cross-community working group on accountability, and we had the accountability and transparency review teams. So there was a little bit of overlap in terms of timing and in terms of scope as well. So I think this is what triggered the operating standards for organizational reviews. So.
Thank you, Manal. This is Rob again. The final candidate, just go quickly flip to two slides, Gulten, is the RDS Who Is To review effort. And for that, I will turn to Catherine to give us an overview and share the news about what's happening with that group. And you can skip right through all my slides if you want to yours.
Thank you very much, Rob, and thanks for having me on this panel to discuss one of the many reviews, and I realize only now sitting up here how many there are. And indeed, there was a problem also with the timing of the reviews, because many were happening at the same time. And as you will appreciate, they demanded an enormous amount of resources. So I think it's important to recognize that the GAC members who are volunteering are making an enormous extra commitment in terms of the workload involved. So it's very much appreciated, I think. But for the registration directory services more particularly, so this is a convoluted name to say we're reviewing how the WHOIS functions. So the official purpose of the review is to assess the effectiveness of the WHOIS and whether its implementation meets the legitimate needs of law enforcement, promoting consumer trust, and safeguarding registrant data. Now, you will appreciate that this came at a very interesting moment in time, because this review is being done as the WHOIS is fundamentally changing. So that was somewhat of a challenge for the review team and has also impacted how careful we were in formulating recommendations. But before I get into the details on that, let me just give you a couple of highlights of our findings and outcomes. Colton, if you could go to the next slide, please. And there are supposed to be some nice pictures that are supposed to revive you from the post-lunch fatigue that show the figures that I was referring to earlier this morning.
I've got them on my screen.
Yeah, I have them on my screen, but I really want to show them to the others as well. So maybe we give Colton 1 minute to pull that up.
Yeah, I didn't expect to see that.
Yeah, it sometimes happens with the PowerPoint. But what I can already give you a little teaser of what's on the slide. So you're going to see a pie chart demonstrating the impact of the unavailability of WHOIS information on law enforcement investigations. And what we saw was that in 52%, so if there's no WHOIS data available, in other terms, what happens to an investigation? In 52% of the time, of the cases, this entails a significant delay of an investigation. And in a full 26% of investigations, the investigation ends right there because there is no data available. What we also asked law enforcement at the time was whether there were alternative sources. So the WHOIS being unavailable, is there any other tool or source of data that could be used to basically enable law enforcement to advance nonetheless on its inquiry? And 60% of participants to the survey said that there was no such tool available, that there was no other source to replace the WHOIS information. 23% said that they didn't know. So it's quite challenging, it seems. And I'll just also tell you about the findings of the impact of the change. So basically, we also asked law enforcement what their, basically to assess what their needs were for the WHOIS. We asked them whether, under the old system, before the temporary specifications came into effect, whether the WHOIS met investigative needs. And before the temporary here we go. So I'll just go back to that slide briefly. So as I was saying, this is the survey that we ran under the RDS review team auspices. It's a small survey, but we believe it is representative, and it basically shows in color the impact of the unavailability of WHOIS information. So now you can see it once more in color. And thank you, Gilton. If we could just move to the next slide. I also don't want to keep the TSG waiting. And we also asked about the impact of the change from the old WHOIS system to the temporary specifications. And as you can see here on your left, before May 2018, 98% of respondents said that the WHOIS met their investigative needs at least partially. With the change affected by the temporary specifications, we now see that 67% of respondents say that the WHOIS no longer meets their investigative needs. If we move to the next slide, please. So just to summarize very briefly, we assessed as part of our review process the recommendations that were made by the Who Is One review team, which concluded its work in 2012, so basically the predecessor to our review team, which provided a total of 16 recommendations to ICANN board, of which 8 were fully implemented, 7 partially implemented, and 1 was not implemented at all. And by my count, I actually have 6 implemented, 9 partially, and 1 not at all, so it doesn't quite match the slide. And we also adopted a number of new recommendations to basically address the shortcomings of the implementation of the first one and new problems that we discovered. So if we just go to the next 2 slides very quickly, we particularly focused, and I hope these slides will be shared, on the strategic priority that needs to be given to WHOIS and the RDS system as a function of ICANN, and to law enforcement and public safety needs in particular. And given that there is policy work going on, our recommendations are very much focused on just supporting the work of the new policy development team. But I don't want to go into the details here in view of time, but the larger point that I would like to leave you with is that consistent with what has been found by some of the other review teams who were following up on prior review teams, such as the Security and Stability Review Team, there are concerns about the degree of implementation of recommendations from review teams. So when analysis has been done, in many cases, the implementation was found to be far from perfect. And given that reviews under the bylaws are really the primary mechanism for accountability of ICANN and of the community, it is at least a challenge to the system to come to this conclusion across so many different reviews that, in fact, reviews' recommendations are not fully being implemented. And, of course, we have a new situation now with the CCT review team's recommendations, where we've just heard earlier today that a number of the only 6 of the recommendations have been fully accepted by the board, and a number of others have been referred out to other processes or relegated for further consideration. And that, I think, is a larger horizontal point that we need to consider in the context of the accountability of the organization overall. And for us in particular, we need to consider how this affects the implementation of the GAC advice provided, first of all, through the Beijing safeguards in 2013, and then through the Helsinki communique, which basically mandated that before any subsequent GTLD rounds were to be considered, reviews needed to be completed and recommendations by extension needed to be implemented, so that we could be sure that we were creating, that any extension of the domain space we were creating would be done in a way that did not lead to further security risks for the domain space. I'll stop here in view of the time and turn it back over to Manal. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rob and Catherine. And I invite the technical study group to join us here on the panel, please. Thank you.
Hi, Manal. Good to see you. It's just a few, not everybody. There's only a few who are going to be presenting.
Are we going to have enough space? No, we think it's going to be too tight.
So thank you. Thank you, everyone. And we are now starting our meeting with the technical study group on access to GTLD registration data. And first of all, thank you for accommodating our request on a short notice. I understand also that you had a community engagement session on Monday, but unfortunately it was conflicting with our GAC meetings. So that's why we requested this meeting. So thank you for your flexibility. Shall I hand over to you, Catherine?
Yes, thank you very much. And just to sort of situate this once more for the GAC, so the Technical Study Group has provided options for possible implementation of policy yet to be developed. And as we discussed earlier today, this is extremely helpful because it can actually show options for implementation that can in turn inform the policy as it is being developed, because as the technical study group identifies specific technical solutions that, for example, could be particularly privacy protective or particularly secure, that helps in the data protection assessment that needs to be made as part of the policy development process, which is why we suggested earlier that this is a process that the GAC warmly welcomes and that also should continue, hopefully, alongside the EPDP phase two. And with that introduction, may I pass the floor to Ram.
Catherine, thank you, and Manal, thank you as well. And I really appreciate having us here. And we are cognizant that there's about 30 minutes in here. So I just wanted to go through a few things on in our presentation and really try and keep most of our time available for questions and interaction. So the first thing, who are we and what are we about? So if you could please go to the next slide. There you will find a URL up there, and that URL will provide you much greater information about the details, but including the charter of the group. But the motivation and the background of forming the technical study group was to balance data protection requirements with legitimate interests of third parties to access non-public data, as well as an intent to reduce potential liability. Now, while those were the motivations, the technical study group itself, our purpose is to explore technical solutions for such access to non-public data in the GTLD space. We are absolutely been quite clear that we are not going to be making any decisions or recommendations on policy questions, and several of them have come up already. Things like who gets access, should it be called access, which data fields, under what conditions should access be provided, what is a legitimate interest, all of those kinds of things, we are not making any opinions or providing any recommendations in that area. On the next slide, you'll see a listing of who are the actual members of the technical study group. I'm the coordinator of the group. I picked the team members there, and I helped form the group. But you'll see that there is, across the board, the common theme amongst the members is very strong subject matter expertise and very strong technical knowledge and expertise. That really is the distinguishing factor. We've been quite lucky to have excellent support from the folks at ICANN.org as well. On the next slide, you will see that we went through a collaborative process and an iterative process, and in that iterative process, we had a few ways of arriving at decisions. One of the things that we did was we said, our decision-making in the technical study group is going to be consensus-driven. Number two, it's going to be iterative. And number three, what we're going to be doing is focused on the technical pieces rather than policy pieces. With that said, let me pass the microphone to you, Steve, and ask you to quickly go through the assumptions that that we have arrived at.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Ram. So Ram has emphasized that we're a technical group formed to put together a solution within a certain framework that is delineated by a set of assumptions that were handed to us, basically, not the ones that we made. If you read the report, there's 12 assumptions that are listed. I've taken six of them here. They're referenced in the numbers in parentheses. The basic picture to have in mind is that access to non-public GTLD data will be through an ICANN-mediated gateway, and that ICANN-mediated gateway will handle the issues of credentials and authorizations and so forth. And you'll hear more about the various possibilities for the way that's put together. This isn't an implementation picture. It's just a kind of notional picture. And that, in addition, queries from unauthenticated sources will be handled with as dictated by policy. And so that's the – oh, and that RDAP. RDAP is the solution mechanism. It's a mechanism to be used to build a system, and port 43 will be deprecated over time. And all of this, of course, is to shift the liability, not necessarily 100%, but to reduce liability on the registrars and the registries. That's the positive service that ICANN is providing in this.
Thank you, Steve.
I assume it's one slide, yeah.
Yes, thank you, Steve. If you could take us to the next slide. Andy, could you just briefly walk through the some of the rest of these pieces without, you know, getting into the minute detail?
Yes. So the after we went through the assumptions, we discussed use cases and user journeys, and we came up with a set of five use cases. Broadly, you know, users who are authorized to have access to the data, but only, you know, are submitting one or two queries. Users who are authorized but may want to submit many queries. Users need to who are authorized need to be expedited in their requests. Unauthorized or unauthenticated users and what to do about them, and then also the actual registrants or the data subjects themselves. From there, we went on to system requirements, and we looked at different components of the system and what the requirements would be on those components, and then we also had some overall requirements. So the requirements are things like there, you know, we must be using secure protocols where applicable or the applicable secure protocols, things about passing data between the different parts of the system and what data should be passed that the system should support. Other pieces of it, such as the logging of the data and data retention around logs, reconciliation of log files, etc., and information security practices about the system itself. So those are the basic system requirements that we had.
Thank you, Andy. If you could please take us to the next slide, Scott.
Thank you, Ram. So the technical model that we came up with is based on three standards-based technologies: RDAP, as described previously, OpenID Connect to help us with client identification and authentication, and OAuth 2.0 to help us with authorization. The graphic that you see here describes the flow of information between the various actors in the system, and you'll note that it's a little bit more complicated than the traditional client-server model that you may be familiar with in terms of the way WHOIS is implemented. We have a few additional actors here. We have the ICANN RDAP access service, and we have the identification, authorization, and access control functions separated between an authentication provider and an authorization service. And the way this works assumes, first off, that there are a couple of prerequisites, right? These identity provider functions have to exist, you know, before this system can be implemented. There needs to be some exchange of configuration information between the various parties, because as web services, these functions interact through the exchange of information via URLs. And so when, for example, a client wants to talk to an RDAP access service, it sends information to a specific URL. All right, and then once these actors exist, and they have exchanged their configuration information, there is a need for the identity provider function to issue credentials to end users or requestors. Right? This is something we don't have in WHOIS today because we don't have the ability to identify and authenticate end users. But with RDAP, we can do this. So the way a query works with this model, once a credentialed user decides that they need to perform a query, they send their query to either the ICANN RDAP access service if they are requesting non-public information, or one of the contracted parties if the information they are requesting is deemed to be public information. Let's ignore the public information case, that's not too interesting, and focus instead on the non-public data. When the ICANN RDAP access service gets a request, it receives information about the identity of the requestor and what they're asking for. But because it does not know anything about that identity, it depends on the services provided by these identity provider functions. And since it was pre-configured in terms of who the identity providers are, to perform the identification function, the access service does a HTTP redirect to this authentication provider function. And the way this works is if you're familiar with single sign-on services, if you've ever visited a website and you're asked if you can log on with your Google credential or a Facebook ID or a Twitter handle, it's the same underlying technology. So what the user will see at first is some type of a login prompt where they're requested to provide their credentials and or their password. And assuming that all checks out okay, they're then asked to give consent to share information about themselves with this ICANN RDAP access service. And the type of information that we're envisioning here will be things like the purpose of their query, the role that they are performing, the legal jurisdiction in which the query is being issued from. The complete list of these types of attributes is a matter of policy. It's not something we focused on other than noting that we need to have this type of information. Right? So the client does this. They give their explicit consent for this information to be shared. And then there's an exchange of information between the authentication provider and the ICANN RDAP access service. This identification information is given to the access service, who then has to make an authorization decision. It's like, I know who this entity is, but I don't know that they are allowed to see what they're asking for. That function is performed by sending a query to the authorization service. And as you might imagine, that there is a significant amount of policy work that has to happen here, because this policy has to be mapped to some type of a profile against which the identification information and query information can be mapped. All right, so let's ignore how all that magic happens for a moment, but just assume that there is some type of a mapping function performed, and the authorization service will return either a yes or a no. The end user is authorized to see what they're asking for or not. Right? In the case of not, they get back a very uninteresting, empty RDAP response for the most part. But in the more interesting case of yes, they're authorized, the RDAP access service then sends queries to the contracted party RDAP servers. These are registry servers, registrar servers, as appropriate to retrieve the requested information. It forms that information into a full RDAP response and then sends the full RDAP response back to the client, who displays it for the end user.
Thank you, Scott. I know that was quite a bit of technical detail and technical information, but the way I would suggest you look at this is that this diagram here is really the primary model, and the key points that I wanted to bring out to you is that there is an ICANN RDAP access service, but access to non-public information has two other steps in there, an authentication as well as an authorization step in there. And the way we've attempted to design this is to provide flexibility so that as the requester of this information, if you want to have credentials that last only for a single query, for a single object, or if you want to have credentials that last in a persistent manner, or if you want to have access to data not just for one object but for multiple objects, all of those permutations and combinations that exist, this model accommodates those permutations and combinations, right? So that's the one thing. The other thing that we had a very helpful interaction in our last meeting with some technical folks from Europol, and they provided us with very helpful thoughts on what kinds of technologies might actually be easier to implement versus harder to implement, across multiple places. Benedict can speak to that, perhaps.
I think what we learned from Europol is that authentication mechanisms within law enforcement and government are diverse, not necessarily exposed, and will require a certain amount of interfacing to any authentication mechanism that's exposed here. One interesting question that's I think strays into policy, but it's worth flagging here, is that what we haven't described on screen here is the upfront accreditation process, and I think that is something that the people in this room will want to probably concern themselves with, although we don't opine on it as part of this technical group.
Thank you, Benedict. Part of those consultations and our own discussions led us to a fairly fundamental principle, which is to try and keep the model as simple as possible, and try and keep in mind that every single technology choice that adds a little layer of complexity ends up having the likelihood of being multiplied, because as Benedict was saying, the authentication mechanisms certainly in law enforcement and government are very diverse. If you could take us to the next slide. Thank you. So just to walk you through what our plans are, we are in the community. Now we're looking for feedback. We're looking for your suggestions and your comments. The document itself in full is published on the ICANN.org/TSG URL. So you could go there and you can look at the entire document. So we're looking for input to come from you. The TSG plans to meet over the next few weeks, and in the middle of April, we expect to finalize the technical model that you see the draft of right now. Our plan, and we're currently on track, is to publish that model on the 23rd of April, at which point the TSG will consider its work done and will be wrapped up. So with that, I'll hand it back to you, Catherine. Or Manal.
So we're opening the floor for questions, right? So any questions? Yes, US, please go ahead.
Thank you all again for the presentation, and you already know I have a whole list of questions. So I won't plaster you with all of them, just to maybe one, and I'll follow up again if there's more time. But one of the questions that my colleagues have is with respect to the ability for reverse searches. Will that capability be allowed? I realize there's a policy issue associated with this as well, but in terms of technical capability, is that possible?
So currently RDAP itself does not support reverse search. There is a draft in the IETF that will be coming up in Prague to discuss the protocol extension for doing that. And once that makes its way through the IETF, this is much more of a viable question to answer. I will note that the model that we have presented will allow the harder part of the reverse search to be done in a more clear fashion, which is who do you query for the reverse search? And that's kind of just the protocol parts, the extensions that the IETF will discuss can't actually answer that, but our model is a much better, has a good way of answering that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Eswatini, please.
Will the RDAP provide some kind of obligation on the part of the registrar or registry to respond to the query?
So in our model, yes, there is an obligation for the registrar or registry to reply to an answer sent to it by the ICANN gateway.
So any other questions. So I have Catherine. Okay, go ahead first.
Yes, Javier Gil Ruiz, representing Spain, for the record. I am sure you will be aware of the predicament I am going to mention, but maybe an explicit mention could be made. I assume the intermediary server will be keeping a log of the queries done and of the querying entities, if only to comply with GDPR. On the other hand, I am sure you know from your contacts with Europol and other law enforcement that the law enforcement agencies will insist on these queries being kept secret. How quick will you approach this problem?
Sure. Could you please bring up the schematic diagram again? But there are a couple of facets to the answer of that question. The report that we wrote touches on the logging topic in great detail. This particular presentation was modified, due to the short amount of time that we have, so we didn't go into it in any detail. But yes, there are definitely requirements there in terms of how logs are collected, how that they are maintained, and now requirements. Remember, they're really suggestions from us to the community. As engineers, we are saying, look, this is something you need to think about. Policies will need to be developed. But we also had discussed a little bit about the specific concerns of law enforcement and whether or not their requests should be tracked and audited, and the capability to add an identity attribute to a law enforcement credential certainly exists. So assuming an appropriate credential issuer would be authorized to issue that particular permission, the model will certainly be able to accommodate that type of a requirement.
I think one thing that you might want to consider, and this is information that's new to me and came out of our presentation with our recent discussion with the registrar stakeholder group, is that we were asked questions by the registrar stakeholder group if that identifying information would be passed not just from client to the access service, which as a former law enforcement officer doesn't make me that concerned, but whether that there would be identifying information also passed from the access service to the registry or registrar RDAP servers. And so reading between the lines of the questions we were receiving, it seemed that some of the registrars would like for there being identifying information to be passed to them in order that they could make their own determination as to whether the requests were legal or not. So again, we make no determination about that, but that might want to be a policy discussion that you have with contracted parties about your levels of risk and their levels of liability. I hope that's clear.
Thank you. I have US.
Thank you. I'd like to defer to the UK because I think they had a question and I've already asked once. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. Chris Lewis Evans here. So, as you know, cybersecurity professionals and IP rights holders provide law enforcement with a wide amount of information when they find criminal activity. As you've shown, it's possible to have different levels of access technically, and obviously dependent on policy, so assuming there's a policy that limits the amount of information that some of these parties are able to see. Did you have a look at being able to provide either anonymized or pseudo-anonymized data to them so they could still build up the picture that they are able to provide a full case information to law enforcement?
So, yes, we did discuss that. And the framework that we have provided will support that. The question of whether something is anonymized or pseudo-anonymized, really, and how that is done, and what type, if you're talking about pseudo-anonymity, what type is really a policy question. But the framework will support that.
Thank you. Do you have a question? I'm sorry, can you please come to a microphone and identify yourself?
Hello, this is Afifa from Bangladesh, Coach for Fellow. So you mentioned about single sign-on in the architecture using the Facebook and Gmail account. So I wanted to know, do you think it's a best practice? My concern was if the Facebook and Gmail account is ever get compromised, then there is a risk of, you know.
Thank you. I think that's a great question. I think we were using the example of Facebook or Gmail or Twitter just to explain how the technology works rather than recommending or suggesting that you use Facebook or Gmail or anything like that. You know, our expectation is that when such a service is actually stood up, our recommendation is that there would be the ability to use that technology underlying it rather than actually recommending that you should use Facebook or Gmail. Scott, did you want to expand any further?
You covered it well.
Thank you.
Anything else before we wrap? Yes, European Commission, please.
Yes, Georges Solens for the European Commission. You made clear from your presentation that there are a lot of policy questions pending. But assuming that those policy questions are answered, can you give a sort of estimation of timescale for an implementation of such a model?
Thank you for that question. I'm actually going to turn to perhaps Gavin, if you're here. And also Scott, because it's a question on, you know, feasibility and implementation. So, and you have some direct experience that perhaps you can speak to.
Sure. So some of this actually still has to go through the IETF's standardization process, right? We have an internet draft that describes this approach, you know, to add this extension to RDAP. It's been cooking now for about 4 years. Now, please don't make, I don't want you to think that 4 years means that there's been 4 years of controversy. It's more along the lines of, I just started working on this 4 years ago, and the community is just now catching up, right? But I can also say that we tested this technology as part of the ICANN GTLD RDAP pilot implementation program. So there is code out there that's running that, you know, that actually implements this technology. And so I say this because I think once the policies finally exist and we have all the standardization work done, it's not going to be a huge uplift, you know, from a software development perspective, right? In fact, you know, quite a bit of this is actually available in the form of open source software right now. It would need to be modified, right, because nobody is providing this software in the context of RDAP implementation. So, you know, those kinds of features would need to be added. And the need to stand up these authentication providers and authorization services is brand new. So there's going to be a lot of time, you know, required, you know, to get a handle on what those really look like and who's going to be doing it and what the responsibilities are and what the code of conduct is, et cetera. But the good news is that the technology is sound and the technology won't be the bottleneck in terms of actually bringing this to fruition.
Yeah, I'd like to follow on, maybe slightly less optimistic sentiment. I think Scott's right that the kind of fundamental technology is pretty well established now, and the in terms of building or coming up with new ideas and new things, there's not going to be much of that needed to get something like this up and running. I think where the delay will come from is the operationalization. Because there is the potential that, you know, depending on the outcome of the policy development process, this system may need to operate at significant scale with significant complexity in terms of how the authorization process works. There's going to be we've made a number of recommendations and considerations for the ICANN organization in terms of things like data retention policies, service level agreements, audit functionality, transparency reporting that would need to be, you know, encoded into operational practices. I suspect that's going to be the single biggest source of time to deployment.
Thank you very much. I have one more question from Belgium, and then I'm afraid we have to wrap. So, Belgium, please go ahead.
Thank you, Manel. Don't worry, I won't repeat my question of yesterday about the contractual relationship between the providers and the registries. But I would like to know what kind of provider you see for the authorizations, because for authentication it won't be so difficult, I mean, at least for law enforcement bodies to find a provider. But for the authorization, it's quite difficult competence. So do you see any actors?
Okay. That's a very interesting question, and you honed right in on the most difficult part of this model, right? I think the identity provider function is a little easier to explain, and I like to look at this in the context of communities of interest. These are typically actors who have a relationship with the end users. They know who they are, they're willing to issue credentials, and they're willing to vouch for those credentials. And if you think of, when I say credential, it's something that looks like an email address. Is commonly how these are represented. And so the entities that currently maintain these communities are likely identity providers in the future. Organizations like Interpol or Europol or WIPO or INTA, APWG, et cetera. The authorization service is brand new, though. And I'm not exactly sure how that might get implemented. It may be a contract function. Something that ICANN does in terms of accreditation providers who perform this particular service. Ram, any other thoughts on that end? Or Andy?
Thank you. Let me pass it to Gavin, and then I'll have a couple of comments on that.
Okay. All I was going to say is in our report, we talk about the different models, actor models, and the model where ICANN functions as the sole authorizing party. Is the one that we felt was the most appropriate given the other constraints in the system.
Thank you. Just one last word on that piece. We the way we have drawn this schematic and we have imagined it, we've explicitly tried to make them separate components and separate functions, but in an actual implementation model, there is nothing that stops it from being combined and the function being provided by one or more one entity. So, but we're doing this in the most explicit case that it's all done by separate parties.
So, thank you again. Thank you very much. Thanks to the technical study group, and thank you, GAC colleagues, for the interactive discussion. And I urge you to go and look into the full report and hopefully provide any comments before the group meets in April, you said? Okay. So, thank you again. Thanks, everyone. Please be back in the room at 3:15 sharp. We'll be meeting with the board at 3:15. Thank you.
Thank you.